The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Now listen, I know lots of you out there were absolutely fascinated, morbidly so, by the mushroom poisoning case in Australia. So if you are in that category, and like I say, lots of you are, well, hold on to your hats because we've got a great story for you. I say great, I mean, there's a morbid element to all of this as well, which should be acknowledged. But this is the case of the Denver dentist. So it's Denver, Colorado in the United States, where a local, James Craig, was sentenced recently to life in prison for the murder of his wife, Angela Craig, 2 years after her mysterious death. But not only was Craig convicted of murder, but he was also convicted of several other counts, including solicitation to commit murder, which came about when he tried to enlist a fellow inmate when he was on remand to kill the lead detective investigating his wife's death. Anyway, morbidly fascinating stuff. And Lauren Mathias is with me, who's an American journalist and the host of the Hidden True Crime podcast and the YouTube channel as well. Lauren, you're very welcome to the show and thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us. I tell you what, we'll begin at the beginning. You might explain who the main characters are in this. Who is James Craig? How did he meet his wife?
Yeah, James Craig is a LDS or Mormon, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints member, a father of six children and a husband of 23 years to his wife, Angela Craig. So they met, like most LDS young couples do, very young, going to college at a church-owned university, and they end up, he goes to dental school, they end up having six children together. So that's what I think also makes this such a bizarre case, is the backgrounds of these two and how this isn't like a girlfriend of a year. I mean, not that that would matter. Like, I mean, that's still horrible, but it's so shocking that this happened in this situation.
So they are on the face of things happily married. The Mormon honeymoon or dream couple, rather. They've got the six kids. He's a dentist. All things are looking good. What we learn, though, is that infidelity becomes a feature of their marriage. So you might tell me about that. And right up to the point where he makes this bizarre reference to the movie The Purge and what he would like to do to his wife in that context.
Yeah. So, yeah, he owns his own dental practice, actually. And we learn in trial, and I sat through a lot of the trial actually in Denver, and he actually, while at the trial, he mentions to the sugar baby. So we learned during the trial that he has been cheating, not just for a year or 2 years, but likely their entire 23-year marriage. And these sugar babies, as they're called by the court, these arranged relationships where he pays them money and they date him, they testify that honestly, he had said to them, "Hey, you know, if I could do one thing to my, you know, and get away with it, it would perhaps be to kill my wife." That one of them testified on the stand to that. So sort of this shocking element of plotting and planning and thoughts that he's been having for quite some time.
Okay. So there's an element of rot in the marriage, all this infidelity. He is talking fairly openly with some of these women, these sugar babies, about what he'd do to his wife. So talk to us then about what we learned about what he did to his wife.
Yeah, this was not, I mean, you mentioned the Australia mushroom case, which is so bizarre, right? But this is also just so bizarre in a very different way. He used arsenic, cyanide, eye drops, tetrahydrozoline, which is found in Visine eye drops in the United States, and oleander, all of these different poisons that he was having delivered or seeking out. And he did this within a 10-day period of her suffering, and made protein shakes for her, and then and different types of food. Even when she was being hospitalized, he would go and visit her and then bring, you know, a fast food meal or another protein shake, or be taking care of her and saying, "I'm so worried about you. You're so sick. Let me come home. Let me make you something," and would be continuing this sort of process. And she was very, very sick for 10 days and doctors couldn't figure it out. And so in and out of the hospital all the time, multiple different poisons that are very difficult to get as well.
So he starts to poison her at home. She immediately gets sick, so sick that she's in hospital. And throughout that time, he continues the poisoning while she's being treated in hospital.
Not just continuing the poisoning, you know, she's suffering. So there's this sort of sadistic, you know, sort of sadistic quality to this. She's suffering and he's texting her. They play all of their texts. They're texting throughout the entire day. She's saying, I don't know what's wrong. And he is feigning, you know, love and concern and let me take care of you. I'm so worried. Maybe you need to go to the Instacare. This isn't okay. Maybe you have diabetes. She's desperately trying to figure out what's wrong and like texting him saying, what do you think? What do you think? And him saying, I'm leaving work. I'm so worried about you. All the while being the cause of it for multiple days, even in the hospital. In fact, and the court has said that he gave the final dose in the hospital. He went to visit her while she was sick, while she was starting to feel better. She had young children at home, were visiting her. He went in and had 5 minutes alone with her. And they believe that he administered the last lethal dose into her IV.
Oh, man. I was about to say, sorry, this is sociopathic behavior. I mean, the decision to kill his wife in the first place is sociopathic behavior, but this is off the charts altogether. That, you know, she's going through all of this turmoil and he's still doing it and he's still feigning the concern and playing the part of the concerned husband. So how soon after her death? So he goes in, he administers this fatal dose literally in the hospital. It kind of beggars belief. How soon after the wheels start to come off for him do investigators start to suspect something is awry?
Yeah. So that moment he walked out of the hospital after administering that fatal dose and said, she's crashed. She's crashed. At that moment, doctors come rushing in and there's something else going on in his dental office at that moment, at that very moment that she's crashing and she's dying. And it's his dental assistant named Caitlin, who is having an emotional affair with him. And she opened an invoice of a private package of his to make sure it wasn't to the office. And it said potassium cyanide on it. And she had to sit with that for a few days and think, there's no way, there's no way, there's no way. She finally told his partner, his dental partner, and said, I have a concern. And so at that moment that she's passing away, his dental partner and assistant are saying to doctors, pulling them aside in the hospital, saying, by the way, heads up. And they're calling in police at that moment. And so it happened very quickly. And so the moment she died, he was actually arrested very quickly. His house was being searched. He couldn't go home with his kids that night. So right at that moment, but I've often thought, and I sat through, you know, I sat through the majority of the trial. I listened every day, whether I was there or not. I do wonder, had that assistant not opened that invoice and saw that potassium cyanide, would he have gotten away with this? You know, we'll never know. We'll never know. But immediately his house was searched and he was arrested a few days later.
And one suspects, I mean, it's a pretty open and shut case on the face of it there. I mean, you're getting potassium cyanide delivered to the office. Your wife has just died of potassium cyanide poisoning, amongst other things. We'll talk in a moment about how he tried to extricate himself from this situation, you know, in terms of having the lead investigator killed and videos made by his kids and what have you. But during the investigation, they unearth, you know, some of the things he did, some of the Google searches, for example, that he had been carrying out that all pointed towards his guilt.
All of these Google searches, how to get away with murder was one of them. Not, I'm paraphrasing that one, but that's essentially what he was Googling. And then he was Googling oleander, which is a poison he used. How to get potassium cyanide. He was Googling Visine eye drops. How much does it take? I mean, very specific Google searches, you know, because I cover true crime, I joke that maybe my Google searches wouldn't look good, but these are to a new level. You know, he is asking exactly how much would it take? How do you get away with murder? How much would this take? And they even have receipts of him shopping at very late at a grocery store, buying 12 packages of Visine eye drops. Those are the ones with the poison in them. His defense tried to claim, oh no, you know, Mormons just like to stock for an emergency. And like, really, at midnight, 12 packages of just eye drops, you need to put these in your food storage. So all of these things leading up to this moment, his Google searches are those, while hers are saying, what's wrong with me? Do I have diabetes? Help me, help me. While his are saying, how do I make this look, you know, like a sickness?
So, I mean, again, on the face of it, such an open and shut case. So then tell me about some of the things he does in prison. We'll start with this this kind of supplementary charge that he's ultimately found guilty of of trying to enlist a fellow inmate to kill.
Yeah, he has these additional charges that are just shocking. If this isn't enough, he's put behind bars awaiting trial, and he tries to get an inmate to different things to kill the lead detective, Bobby Jo Olson. She's a female detective on this case because she is out to get him. He then tries to get another inmate to get him fake suspects that are beautiful women to be able to testify that his wife wanted to commit suicide, wanted to self-harm. So that this was something she wanted to do and he was merely helping her. And then the worst of all of these, in my opinion, is that he writes his daughter, who's a teenager, and says, hey, bail this guy out. He needs to get out. She trusts her dad. She goes and bails this inmate out. And after she bails this inmate out that she doesn't know, this teenage girl, he hands her a handwritten letter from her dad. And in this handwritten letter from her dad, it states, go to the dark web, make a deep fake of your mother. Have the deep fake say that she wanted to kill herself. And trust me on this, do it. Luckily, his daughter at that moment switched teams and realized that she needed to turn her dad in. But even enlisting his own teenage daughter to do this and to save him. So three horrendous things, trying to kill somebody, a hit list from behind bars, as well as enlisting his daughter to go down the deep web, the dark web, and make deep fakes of her now deceased mother.
And I mean, ultimately, he's found guilty of all of this. He's found guilty of the murder. He's found guilty of all these supplementary charges as well, these several other counts, including solicitation to commit murder. That poisoning case, the mushroom poisoning in Australia, captivated the world. I mean, was that true of this case as well? I mean, did it get a huge amount of attention? It didn't seem to kind of cross the Atlantic. It didn't seem to get huge attention here, but did it over there?
No, I agree with you. I think the mushroom poisoning case got a lot more attention. We covered it here in the United States. This case, the family was very private, and the judge helped the family remain private. And so I think that people weren't following it as closely. And a lot of these additional crimes as they happened were sort of underplayed and people weren't learning about them until the trial. I was following it from my place here in the United States. I'm not that far from Colorado. And so I was recognizing it and noticing it, but also noticing that people weren't really grasping what this was. They had heard that a dentist had poisoned his wife. They didn't know how, they didn't know what, they didn't know how manipulative this was. They didn't know how long, how conniving, and they didn't know of his additional crimes behind bars. So I do think it took this trial for people to finally start to pay attention. And I'll be honest, I covered the entire thing because I felt it was so important. I still don't think that it got the attention that it typically would have had people really understood.
And Lauren, I mean, through the course of your work, say, you know, as a journalist, but also with the podcast, the Hidden True Crime podcast, you'd have a good sense of why we are fascinated by certain stories. What is it about something like this or the Australian mushroom case that so enthralls us, given, you know, at some point, at every moment of the day, somebody is on trial for murder somewhere in the world.
Right. That's true. Well, it sort of goes back to the first thing I said. You know, we suspect as a society that this happened because there's a backstory that we don't fully grasp. And maybe, you know, it's a lot of victim blaming. Actually, we do that as a society. And I think it's to make sense of crimes. The victim blaming happens, you know, and I think that in the case like this, this is a person that is a dentist, a business owner, successful. He lived in a $1 million home, religious. He actually was what was called elders quorum in his church congregation, which is a fairly high calling in the LDS faith. He seemed to care. So the sort of the sociopathic element that you mentioned, I think that looking at this as a whole, it's that piece that we think we could have these people around us at any time. Every crime I cover, people will defend the criminal during the investigation. No, I know this guy. He wouldn't do that. You got the wrong person. There's no way. And in the end, what happens? The evidence shows us what it always does and says, well, you were wrong about your neighbor. You were wrong about your pastor. you were wrong about your dentist. And in this case, you were wrong about the husband of 23 years. You were wrong about your father. You were wrong about this church leader. I think it's so shocking. And then you throw in again, not just that manipulation, but the sadistic quality of a 10-day period of suffering of, again, this woman that he was supposed to protect and pretended to protect. You can see it in the text. Like, he certainly pulled the wool over her eyes. I think that it's so hard for us to fathom when people like us, we have empathy. Human beings have empathy. Yeah. We have concern. We have care about one another. And so to come across something like this, it's so hard to make sense of, because clearly there is an empathy chip missing. There is a sociopathic element to this crime. And we try to wrap our head around it. My husband's who is a criminal psychologist, he always says that a better understanding of crime is a better understanding of ourselves. Because in order to understand the world and human beings, we have to understand the worst of us to understand how something like this could possibly happen. And I think so much of trying to wrap our heads around a horrendous crime like this is to try to understand human nature.
I wonder, perversely, is there a comfort we derive in focusing on stories like this where you know, there isn't an explanation, or that there's not a kind of a motive, or they're not driven to it by behavior at home? Because in a way, we can imagine ourselves as those people. You know what I mean? That there's, you know, we all have the kind of the propensity to kind of commit some terrible act if we were to find ourselves in a given situation. Whereas with something like this, despite the fact that it speaks to something primeval, the monsters amongst us, that there's also something on some level comforting about that reality, because we could say, well, I'm not that monster.
Yeah, absolutely. True crime can definitely make some of us feel better about ourselves, right? But I think also, we try, you know, most of us, not all of us, but most of us go to the dentist. You know, some of us go to church. I think we see some of ourselves in all of these stories a little bit. What would I do? What would I do? Would I see this? And I think there was one moment with Caitlin Romero. She is the dental assistant that opened the potassium cyanide invoice and saw it. And she didn't tell anyone for days. And this was her boss. And it was asked of her on the stand, why did you not tell somebody earlier? Why did it take you days? And she said, it was so hard for me to believe that one human being could do this to another human being. Mm. And she just said that as being human, not let alone her boss, not let alone someone she actually really cared about. They were having a bit of an emotional affair, she testified to on the stand. Another human being doing this to another human being, and a wife of 23 years. I think so often we can feel better about ourselves, but I think also it scares us, because we go to dentists, we go to church as society, not all of us, but you know, we maybe connect to a boss that we like. We open an invoice we shouldn't have opened, and we can't imagine that somebody would do something like this. And then, yes, we're like, you know, I think there's a bit of people that follow true crime too. You mentioned it, that think, you know what? I can feel better about myself now. Like, I am like maybe a decently healthy human being. I wouldn't do anything like this. But I think also, I just think the idea that this exists, and as someone that covers true crime, I think it's important to understand that this exists. I think it's important to understand that as long as human beings have been alive, crime has happened. And what is it that sets these people apart from others? Why does it happen? What is the motive? And to understand this sort of human nature.
Yeah, Lauren, if nothing else, I'm going to look at my boss and my dentist in a completely new light in the future. All right. So thank you very, very much for speaking to us. Lauren Mathias is an American journalist. She is a host of the Hidden True Crime podcast and the corresponding YouTube channel as well. So, Lauren, once again, thank you for talking through all of that in such, such great detail.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.